We've been seeing debt rising in recent years at various levels in advanced economies, emerging market countries, in low-income countries as well. And we've seen not just sovereign debt rising, but in some countries, important increases in corporate debt.
Welcome to this podcast produced by the International Monetary Fund. I'm Bruce Edwards, and you just heard David Lipton, IMF First Deputy Managing Director, opening a panel discussion on the issue of rising debt during the IMF World Bank Spring Meetings.
Now, before we all get too deeply into concern about this, one thing I always want to say when talking about debt is that we don't want to start out by suggesting debt is always bad. But, of course, when it's overdone, you can have problems. The world went through a very difficult process of dealing with the debts of low-income countries 25 years ago, starting 25 years or so ago. And I think it is really important that we work together to make sure that that doesn't happen again.
Debt is at record levels around the world. 40% of low-income countries are wrestling with debt distress or high-risk debt levels. And for a few countries in sub-Saharan Africa, the debt crisis has already materialized. Fanwell Bakozi is the executive director for the African Forum and Network for Debt and Development, commonly known as AfroDad, operating across the African continent. Bakozi joined David Lipton in that panel on debt during the spring meetings, and I met up with him after that. So Mr. Lipton today started this discussion by saying that all debt is not necessarily bad. How would you respond to that?
These are the few times when I agree with the IMF that not all debt is bad. Our own organization looks at debt as one of the sources for which African countries can actually use for its development. However, it is also risky that if it is in excess, if it is not used properly, then it undermines the very role that it's supposed to play, which is development. So we say that while debt is good in itself, it should not be the source of the problems in the future.
Mm. And so how big are the problems currently in sub-Saharan Africa in terms of debt?
The problems are huge. If you look at the debt trajectories in Africa, especially if you look at what has happened after the famous debt forgiveness, which people call HIPIC and MDRI, which is Highly Indebted Poor Countries, and the Multilateral Debt Relief Initiative, the African countries' debt levels were reduced because a lot of those debts were forgiven. However, a number of things have actually happened since then. One is that there was the financial global crisis. The financial global crisis that happened in Europe mostly had two effects on Africa. One, there were certain countries that needed to borrow to mitigate the effects of that particular crisis. Yeah. The second thing was that at that particular time, there were certain countries in Africa who were resilient to the problems that actually happened. And therefore, because interest rates in Europe went down, it became a good market for people with capital, excess capital, where they couldn't invest in Europe because the interest rates were low, to find countries in Africa that could actually do that. On the demand side, there was a lot of demand for infrastructure in Africa because at that time, if you look at it, the African Union was getting together and talking about the need for infrastructure as a driver of development on the continent. So you had these huge needs on the African continent for infrastructure, and here are resources that are available, and that actually created a situation where most countries actually borrowed. The problem with that is that not everyone invested the money in the right places. Two is that, coupled with that, after the financial global crisis, African trajectory, economic growth was going up, but recently because of commodity prices going down, you have countries that otherwise didn't have problems having into problems. You're talking about oil prices going down, you're talking about gold prices going down, you're talking about copper and other agricultural products. That has actually created a crisis where countries who had anticipated to have a lot of resources from the exports to repay the loans are now in a situation where it's difficult to repay those loans.
Mm. So you have several countries that are...
Yes. So for example, on the continent, if you look at the increments of debt stock itself between 2010 and 2017, December 2017, that's the statistics that we have, debts actually, the total external debt stock increased by 86%.
Wow.
Within that 10 years. Now, there are several countries that have actually had problems within that period. Talking about the famous Mozambique, people talk about Mozambique, but there are countries like Angola, there are countries like Zambia, there are countries like Ghana who went through a process like that. The other problem that has happened with this debt is that, again, because of that global financial crisis and the trajectory of a growing Africa, it became possible for African governments to raise a lot of funds from issuing sovereign bonds, which are called Eurobonds. And a lot of countries actually raised a lot of bonds. And by January 2019, the total debt stock in terms of sovereign bonds from Africa was close to $90
billion. So I was going to ask you about that, actually, because you mentioned in the talk today that how the beast has changed.
Yes, the beast
has changed. So how has it changed?
The beast has changed in a number of ways. One, if you look at the debt stock before the HIPC, most of the debt was owned by governments of Africa from governments, official, what they call official creditors. And out of those official creditors, the majority of the official creditors were actually the Paris Club. So you had the bilateral lenders and the multilateral lenders, and the majority were the Paris Club. And that's why if a country was in debt problems, they would go to the Paris Club. Now, the proportion of Paris Club loans in the total loan stock of Africa has actually reduced drastically, so that even if the Paris Club came together, they would not have a big influence. It's gone up to probably less than 20% of the total debt stock that is owned. Secondly, a lot of African countries then would not go to the international market. They would never, before 1996, only South Africa and Mauritius were able to issue a sovereign bond. But between then and now, over 20 countries have successfully issued a bond, and it has been, you know, bought on the international debt market. So now you have a different way where you have all these bilateral creditors, loans being smaller, and now they are borrowing from international markets, especially euro bonds. Add to that, you have the Chinese who are coming in, who do loan business in a different way from the traditional creditors that Africa was used to. And then you have a lot of domestic borrowing by governments from private individuals within the country. So if you look at that, it's not the same. It's the same debt, but the nature, the character has actually changed.
So if this does turn into a full-fledged debt crisis in sub-Saharan Africa, what you're saying is it is going to be a lot more difficult to solve than it was perhaps in the 80s.
Exactly the point. It will be more difficult to solve because you have multiple creditors with multiple interests, both political and economic. And would they all want to come together at the same time? Mostly, not likely. Then you have the bond holders, because what happens is that for the bond, these are individuals in Western countries who don't even know their money has gone to a particular country, because they put their money in an investment bank, and it is the investment bank that actually decides to diversify the portfolio, including buying those sovereign bonds. So when a problem comes, they're not going to ask the millions of individuals who put their pensions from Europe, from their work, and say, can we forgive the debt of a country in Africa? It's not going to work. It doesn't even arise as a possible way of going to a pensioner who's put his investment and say, we want you to lose your investment because you have to forgive the loan of an African country. It doesn't make sense.
So how much responsibility should foreign or international banks take for this looming crisis, you know, in terms of their lending practices? Do we need to look at their lending practices?
Yes, for starters, I don't want to assume or come here and make a point that it's only the responsibility of the lenders. It is also the responsibility of the borrowers. And as my organization, we work with our African governments. We have come up with principles of borrowing. We call it the borrowing charter, good borrowing, what you should follow, what principles, parliament should be involved, there should be transparency, you must use the money for what you want to use. So on one side, we've said that. But on the other side, there are creditors who are lending recklessly. They are pushing the money forward because they need to make a quick buck. And that's what is happening. So you heard in that panel cases of countries where they didn't even follow the constitutional or legislative laws of that country in that borrowing. So that's where we're saying that they should have a responsibility. In other words, I mean, we use this example that if I was in Europe, and as a bank, I did not verify whether the person applying for a loan is an underage person. When the time comes and it is proven that they were under the age of 16 or 18, depending on which jurisdiction you were, but you did not verify and you gave them a loan, the responsibility becomes yours. You can't then push that person. We are saying, let's apply the same principles of saying, did this person meet the requirements to actually have a legitimate claim to borrow? And if you don't do that, then you can't claim And that's what we are calling for.
So you've written quite a bit about how tax policy could essentially address some of the issues at the root of this rising debt problem that's been going on for decades, actually.
Yeah.
How do you see tax policy fitting in into the, you know, the potential solution to or finding a solution for this debt issue?
So tax becomes very important. So let's start looking at how we look at development financing on the continent. So one of the first assumptions is that any country has to develop using the money that it raises from within its resources. And taxation is one big chunk of that. Then the second part for African countries was that a lot of that development, if your tax revenues are not enough, then you were able to get grants or donations from well-wishing countries that actually gave you money, and that's development aid. And then if development aid and your domestic raised resources, which basically came from taxation, are not enough for your developmental needs, you actually filled the gap by actually going to borrow.
Right.
So there is a relationship in two ways. One, if your tax revenues are higher, your need to borrow becomes less. But at the same time, if your tax revenues are higher, then you can repay the little loans that you have without jeopardizing the money for development. So tax is at the heart of reduction of debt on the continent. There are issues about how African countries then give away a lot of tax incentives to multinational corporations, to countries outside, in the mistaken belief that foreign direct investment will come. But over the years, it has been proven that investors do not consider tax incentives as one of the critical impediments for them to invest in any country.
It's what's often referred to as the race to the bottom.
Yes, the race to the bottom, where you're actually giving tax incentives, hoping that they'll come to you, because if you don't give tax incentive, then they'll go to the next country. But that doesn't work, because evidence has shown that it is not the tax incentive that actually brings the investors into the country. There are other things that you have to work on.
So what are the risks, do you think, of not addressing this debt issue in sub-Saharan Africa?
The risk of not addressing this debt issue, the first is that there will be an effect on development. We risk meeting the targets of the Sustainable Development Goals. The second risk is that in a lot of African countries, the conflict comes in because of a feeling of not being provided for by the state. Now, if debts lead to a situation where there is little money for governments to do development, they'll have to prioritize. And most of that prioritization ends up in countries where there is a split between where do you put the money. Certain sections of society begin to feel like they are not being treated well, and they can lead to conflict. And that conflict then can lead to migration issues, and there are so many other things that can actually happen. But most of all, it has an effect. It has an effect, as we saw, that these countries are well connected. If African countries have problems repaying their loans, they will not be able to do development. If they don't do development, their people's income will come down. If the people's income come down, then even the West will not be able to make money from exports that are actually saying they make, you know, computers, laptops, and everything that they need to sell. It's going to have a bigger effect. It will affect the international financial system in the end. And that's why this is not only a problem for Africa. As we have seen, the crisis in Latin America affected the whole world. But even now, if we don't solve this, it's going to have ripple effects that will affect the rest of the world.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Fanwal Bokosi is the executive director for the African Forum and Network for Debt and Development, known as AfroDad. You can watch a webcast of the panel on tackling the next wave of sovereign debt crises at imf.org. Thanks for listening. Subscribe if you want to hear more of these podcasts, and follow us on Twitter at IMF_podcast.